Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 181, The Art of Engagement in Organizations, November 7th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
You know, Aristotle said the soul never thinks without a picture. So we do believe that when it comes to people having sort of their central processing unit in their head and their heart, that somehow they may more often than not create a picture of the world around them or around us, and then how we fit into it. But I think when it comes to multiple people, what we're looking at is if a picture is worth 1,000 words, then a metaphor can be worth 1,000 pictures. And what that means is that when it comes to having people really understand business systems or organizational systems, which are true in any time people come together, the ability to visualize that creates a common mental practice field or a brain gym, so people don't spend all the time trying to interpret it. They can spend all their time together figuring how we're going to improve it.
That was the voice of my guest, Jim Howden, CEO of Root Learning and author of the 2008 book, The Art of Engagement, Bridging the Gap Between People and Possibilities. You can find out more about Jim Howden in our show notes at Shrink Wrap Radio. Now, here's the interview. Jim Howden, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
I want to talk to you about your book, your 2008 book, which is titled The Art of Engagement, Bridging the Gap Between People and Possibilities. And I'm eager to explore all the implications of that title, but let's start out with having you share something about your background. How did you get into all this?
Well, I actually have somewhat of an eclectic background. I've been an educator and with advanced business degrees. So I think the answer is that many of the things that I've found that have been successful in my life have been putting uncommon things together to create sort of a breakthrough perspective. And, you know, we have artists and MBAs here, and I think it's kind of a fascinating approach to really create sort of this breakthrough. And in this case, in the noise in many business organizations where people are not fully engaged.
Yes. Well, it's interesting that you have a background in education. Maybe that's why I related to you and your book so well, since I also have a background in education. And even though you're in the world of business, your book is very psychological. And I think the thing that grabbed my attention most about that title is the word engagement, because I've been following the emerging field known as positive psychology. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but the word engagement, both with one's pursuits and with others, seems to be a key component of what's called the good life. So tell us what you mean by engagement.
Well, I think, and maybe this is a long answer, but in many cases, your comment about the pursuit of a good life, I think it's just being totally aware in the sense of being totally revved up and in gear with your pursuits and your endeavors. And I think the big challenge is that if you look at a lot of people and their lives, there are many places where that just happens naturally. I'm fond of saying in the book that I'm a Jimmy Buffett fan and a sports fan, and I can't imagine, you know, going to a Jimmy Buffett concert and being asked as I go through the gate to put on my engagement glasses, or if I, go to a World Series game, given the World Series is going on right now, that we have to be reminded as we go in to be engaged. Yet that natural engagement in many areas of our lives does not easily translate or transfer into our business lives, where we spend 40 to 50% of our waking hours. And to me, there's a huge opportunity there to ask why, and then to begin to sort of find the better way.
Well, why is engagement important in the business environment?
You know, I think what ends up happening is that anything that's successful in life, I think, is so because people provide the best of themselves. Whether that's in an individual endeavor or a joint endeavor, it's how do you combine the best talents and skills and strengths of people into a unified effort that really makes a difference. And I think, as I mentioned, that happens, you know, not only in the sporting and entertainment events I talked about, but it happens at, you know, Cub Scout bake sales, at, you know, all kinds of parent activities. It's happening everywhere there. It's just not happening in the work life. And yet, I think the toll on businesses and organizations is huge. You know, by last count, just disengagement in the U.S. cost the U.S. economy over $400 billion. But I think there's probably even a bigger issue, and that is, I think, if you really wonder or ask people what they're really most fearful of, I think that fear is that they just go through their life and don't really realize how what they do makes a difference. And I think engagement can change that. So, you know, the essence of it is that we can not only engage people to get better results in our organizations, but I think the sense of meaning and purpose that comes from being part of something bigger than yourself is equally and in some cases more important.
You know, when you talk about engagement in this way, it makes me think of jobs that I've had, you know, before I got my degree and went on to my career. And there were jobs that I had, and I'm sure everybody can relate to this experience of some jobs that we've had where you're watching the clock and it's not a high engagement job and time just crawls. And other situations, such as the work that I do now, for example, creating these podcasts, and also my market research consulting, and there's just not enough time in the day. So that's really a big difference, I think, in terms of the impact of engagement is just your whole sense of time and excitement.
I think so, Dave. You know, I think everybody has to work, but not everybody has to provide the discretionary effort that really sort of touches their passion, touches their beliefs, touches their sense, as I mentioned before, of purpose. And I think when we do that, as you suggest, not only does time go past fast, but it just becomes something that is much more enjoyable and that it really becomes more productive.
Yes. Now, you tell a story in your book. In the first chapter, you tell a hot dog story that I love. Would you mind retelling it here?
Sure. You know, I think the whole premise of the hot dog story was built out of personal experiences. But, you know, I'm from Ohio, so in Ohio, and I'm also a sports fan. So in Ohio, there is a team called the Cleveland Indians, and the Cleveland Indians are a baseball team that I grew up being a tremendous fan of. The only dilemma was that they were just awful, and they were awful most years, and so as the season started, you know, you had just the beginning of the season where you still had hope, but pretty quickly you sort of gave way to just despair because they weren't going to be any good again this year. As a matter of fact, they were so bad that they made Hollywood made two movies about the Indians, and they were spoof movies. It was called Major League One and Major League Two, where it was sort of the team that really couldn't accomplish anything. And so the problem was not only did I have this life of being a fan of the Cleveland Indians, I sort of infected my children with the same disease, so they were also Indian fans, and I was never admired as sort of picking a winner every year because, again, 1 or 2 months into the season, we were waiting for the next year. But finally, in 1995, they made it to the World Series for the first time in 40 years. And so if you can imagine just the excitement not only that I had but my children had, and that for the first time in their lifetimes and mine at that point, they were going to be in a championship game. And so we were not only going to the game, we were the first ones in the gate. So we were there that night, and it was a night game, and it was surreal. If you can imagine, you know, some of these events just become absolutely almost fantasy-like in terms of the energy and the excitement and the anticipation. And you know, and everybody in the stadium was felt like they were brothers and sisters, and being more polite than ever and high-fiving, and so and we made our way to our seats. And just about the time when the game was just going to start, I also had two gentlemen with me from Mercedes that we had been working with, and just before that first pitch.
They were from Germany, right?
In Germany, correct.
Yes.
And they were, so it was just before that first pitch of that first game in the World Series for the Indians in 40 years, they asked me if I could go get them some hot dogs. And I said, basically, excuse me? I said, don't you realize this is the first time this team has been in this championship in 40 years? It is absolutely a moment of great energy and thrill. I have my children here. I said, I really don't care how much money you spend with us, but I'm not going to go get you any hot dogs. I said, you know, sit down and relax and watch the game. Probably about the third inning, a friend of mine leaned over and says, I now really understand what you guys do. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, not only do I understand what you do, I understand what you're passionate about. He said, it just all hit me. He said, you know, at the start of this game, there were 42,000 people in this stadium that really understood the game. There was no need to explain it to them. They absolutely understood the dynamics of it, how it is played. They understood, you know, what was critical to success, and they were absolutely waiting for that first pitch. And he said, and two, didn't have a clue, and they did, you know, and they wanted to get a hot dog. He said, at the same point, there were 41,998 that understood how to keep score. They understood what were the efforts and activities necessary to create score and what were the ones to prevent score. And the same 41,998 understood the strategy, which at this point were the lineups for each team to get put on home plate before the first pitch, was not something that was sort of just static and you would check in a year later how it evolved. It was something that after the first pitch, all 41,998 people were talking about the what-ifs. What if this happens? What should we do? What if that happens? What should we do? What if this goes this way? How do we respond? And they were absolutely captivated by the drama of this potential game. And he said, you know, and absolutely there were two that didn't have a clue. And he said, you know, in most companies we have 42,000 people. 41,098 that do not understand the game, do not understand how it's played, do not understand how competition is changing, do not understand how competitors are emerging, do not understand how the essential value that we're trying to deliver. They do not understand the villains and the heroes in that whole process. And by the way, there's more drama in our businesses, in our organizations, than there is in the sitcom Desperate Housewives, but we just haven't found a way to really bring that to life. So the second thing is they really don't understand how we're going to keep score. You know, in the business case, where the money comes from and where it goes and how they can add more coming in and how they can keep more from going out and how all that money is part of a circulatory system that continues this body to move forward. And he said, and finally, most people, 41,098 people in an organization, think that the strategy is something that we give them, and that, you know, they ought to just go try it, and it's just absolutely static, and only, you know, the two remaining people in the organization really understand how dynamic it is. And, you know, and I think the reality is that it is absolutely a call to action, that if we can, in our recreational lives, find 41,998 people that understand the game, understand how to keep score, and understand the strategy is a starting point, not an end point, and that they play a critical role in responding to the evolution of that, that it is something that can happen in business. And as a matter of fact, just to take it a step further, I mentioned that the absence of engagement in businesses cost the U.S. economy $400 billion last year. There is another $10 billion that the U.S. economy was sort of shortchanged on because of all the people playing fantasy football and fantasy baseball in the U.S. And what that means is that there are people from 4 to 94 that set up teams, that they choose players, that they play in a game, that they get the results, that they modify their team, they modify the players, they go back and play again, and they're constantly in the game. And just to show you the irony of all this, Before the season was over, my dad is 82, and I went over to his house to watch the Indians game. And unfortunately, he had the Yankees game on, and he had it on. And I said, "Why are you watching the Yankees? We're Indians fans." And he said, "I have a fantasy player on the Yankees." And I said, "I can't believe it. Turn the Indians game on. This is what I really wanted to watch." But the point being is that we are so capable of understanding a game, of understanding the score, at taking corrective actions, at sort of enriching our lives in the spirit of competition, the challenge, the sense of achievement, yet we have not been able to do that in many of the places where we work and spend a majority of our time day in and day out and week in and week out.
Yes, I love the way your friend commenting on the hot dog event kind of turned the numbers upside down, because at the baseball game, the great bulk of people were engaged, and there were two guys who were kind of out of it and didn't know the score, didn't know what was going on, whereas in most organizations, it's the other way around. There are just a few guys at the top who have the big picture, the big vision, and the rest of the people are kind of blind because they're not engaged. Let me have you tell another story that maybe builds on the same thing. It's the story in chapter 2 about the three bricklayers.
Yeah, I think this one, David, is an interesting one, and I think it's the story goes, a child goes up to a building site and asks a mason, or a bricklayer rather, what he is doing, and he rather perfunctorily sort of says, "You know, can't you see what I'm doing? I'm laying bricks." And so his vision is very tactical, and his sense of what he's doing is clearly a job. As the story goes, he goes up to another gentleman who is also laying bricks and asks this gentleman what he's doing. And it's beyond the job, but his response is, "I'm building a wall." And so the child looks at what he's accomplishing and what he's doing, and finally he goes up to a third bricklayer and he asks the gentleman what he is doing. And his response is, "I am building a cathedral that will house many people for years and allow them to worship together and allow them to come together to create great deeds." And so I think the real question is, you know, how do we really create a sense of what we're about in a way that allows people to truly see the outcome of what their work and effort is? And it's interesting, David, because I think the real question is, whose responsibility is that? I'm going to launch into one quick story on that issue, because I can remember being with a teacher back to my education days, and I remember asking the teacher, how she decided what to teach. And she said, "Well, I teach according to the minimum standards. I don't have a lot of flexibility." And then I pushed her further. I said, "No, really, how do you decide what to teach?" And she said, "Well, I teach to the minimum standards." And I said, "No, I said, you're in fifth grade. How do you decide what to teach?" She said, "Well, I have to teach what's after fourth grade and before sixth grade." And finally, the fourth time I pushed her, I said, "I understand all that. What do you decide what to teach?" And she said, "Well, I teach what I like." And I said, rather simply, "What if what you teach is not what your students like?" And the whole answer, or the question, was really, whose responsibility is it to bring relevance to that classroom? And the same question is to that bricklayer's building site, or to our organizations where people work, whose responsibility is it to bring relevance? And we absolutely believe that the manager and the leader has a unique opportunity to translate the stories of a business into something that is relevant to their people. But the starting point of that, almost in the spirit of employees as customers, is with the individual, and not with, as the teacher said, what I like.
Okay, these are great stories, and they seem to stress the importance of everyone in the organization having the big picture, and that's where the meaning comes from. Are there any companies that come to mind that have been particularly successful at doing what you're describing?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think we have, I think the Hilton Brands in Hampton is very good at that. I think one of the things that is a challenge in any organization where you have a franchisor and franchisee, which is a little different flavor of what we've been talking about, is that, you know, you can go to sort of your respective corners and have different polarized point of views. You know, the franchisor is trying to have a consistent brand experience for customers, and the franchisee may be trying to maximize their investment in the four or five hotels that they own. But the real question becomes, how do we come to a big picture about this business that we really align on and can co-drive to the success of the business? And Hampton Hotels has been one of the shining lights, I think, in the hospitality industry. And by looking at the big picture of the traveling customers' needs and how those can be met and how both the franchisor and franchisee can respond to those, I think is one example where the ability to look at the big picture together has really helped those two key players in the Hampton brand to come together and really perform admirably, and I think really have just an outstanding experience for many of their guests. I think another example would be Harley Davidson. Over the years, Harley Davidson has had ups and downs, but I think one of the things that Harley has been very clear on is trying to really take their business to their people. And so in the baseball story example, to make sure that they understand the big picture, to make sure they understand the economic system, and quite frankly, to also make sure they understand what customers value the most and how we can get it to them. So I think they have been, over the years, very successful at that. And so, but there are a number of companies that I think have really caught on to this concept of the big picture. And part of the reason for that, David, is because it can be a very fast language for organizations that are really trying to get people to sort of see the business as a system, not unlike baseball as a system.
Yeah, and you say a fast language. Things we know that things are moving very fast these days. And I want to underscore, at one point you used the word organizations, and I want all my listeners, even if they're not involved in some kind of big corporate business, I think everything that you're saying, really, we're all in organizations of one sort or another, whether it's clubs or small business or parent-teacher organizations. And I think a lot of the things that you're saying, if not all of them, apply to all sorts of organizations in our lives. And there's a place where you outline four points that I think really are very important psychological points that I agree with and for which I think there's a lot of scientific support. And the points I'm referring to are, one, people want to be part of something big. That makes a lot of sense to me. Two, people want to feel a sense of belonging. Three, people want to go on a meaningful journey. And four, people want to make known that, or people want to know that their contributions make a significant impact on the journey.
Yeah, I think, David, those are absolutely correct. And if I could just touch on those really quickly, this issue of be part of something big, I think that when we ask people, what really engages them, they tell us it's part of something big, and they even take and extend that further and say, being part of something bigger than myself. I think people are generally willing to endure personal sacrifice if they can be part of creating something that doesn't exist, and if that can be something worthwhile and meaningful and bigger than just themselves. And it becomes captivating. It becomes compelling. And I think one of the unfortunate pieces of it goes right back to the bricklayers. In many of our organizations, it is not compelling to just lay a brick. I mean, you almost have to say, what's compelling about that? It might be a little more compelling to build a wall, but I can't imagine anything more compelling than to think that you have a legacy, that you've built an environment where tens and hundreds of people will come together to unify and to create meaningful impact in the world around them, and in the sense of a cathedral, and I think that's where we're missing it. You know, we you know, we really stop short of recognizing that there's a huge value if we can translate what we're doing in our organizations into that something bigger than themselves that makes sense. The belonging one is interesting. What I think happens is that we're in times of unprecedented change, and the unfortunate fear, uncertainty, and doubt, which comes up for a lot of people in times of unprecedented change, kind of knock this sense of, do I really belong here? And nothing will cause people to disengage more than feel that it's no longer their team because they can't perform or they're not valued or they can't make the cut. And so I think all of those things are real human emotions that we have to suggest where we want to go. In many of our organizations, we've never been before, so we're going to have to sort of build the bridge as we walk on it. But it's important to extend that emotionally to people so that they know that the organization is behind them and that they're a part of it.
Yes.
And then the third one is this purposeful adventure. You know, it is that sense of the exciting challenge and that is really worthwhile. And, you know, many organizations, we have strategies. My gosh, we could take any, and we actually are doing this, we could take any organization's strategy and turn it into a video game and probably get a lot of people to play it. The problem is they get locked in the caves and closets of organizations, so people don't see it as a challenge. They just see it as a brick again, and we lose the opportunity to just have this sense of excitement that comes from accomplishment. And the final one, this whole belief that an importance that you can see what you do matters in the lives of other human beings. I was in Europe last week talking about the book, and I had a rather unique experience. There was a very large pharmaceutical company there, and a gentleman came up to me afterwards. He goes, I just want to tell you a little story. He said, I have been doing leadership development in our company for the last 15 years. And so we have taken every leader in this organization and put them through all these different courses, and with all due respect, much of it has been just compliance-based so that people could get their ticket punched. He said, I want to tell you, the last one we did, we tried something a little different. So we brought in, you know, 400 leaders, and we put them in tables of 10, so there were 40 tables. And the teamwork activity was to have each of them build a bicycle. And he said, and to be honest with you, that wasn't all that different. You know, they built the bicycle, and some struggled, and some did fine. Some were faster, some were slower. Fights broke out. Collaboration, you know, ensued and all that. And it accomplished all that we had hoped to accomplish from that standpoint. And he said, but the part that we didn't tell people were that there were a bunch of disadvantaged kids in the lobby, and for every table, there was a child that had a number for that table that would receive that bicycle. And he said, so when the session was over, you know, they opened the doors, and these kids came in, and the tables got to meet the kids and get to see this bicycle they just built, who it went to, and understand kind of the difference it made in that child's life. And he said, you know, in all of these years, I received more comments from just that one activity than I have in everything else we've ever done. And he said, this whole idea, regardless of where you are in an organization, that you can see how what your work does impacts sort of the lives of another person cannot be underestimated. And, you know, it was just by coincidence that he told that story. But, you know, I think we forget. I don't care how much money you make. I don't care how many accolades you have. And I don't care how successful you've been. I don't think we can ever diminish the need to really continue to identify with the fact that what we do matters, and especially if it matters to other people.
Yes, amen. Now, you talk about disengagement, which is the opposite of engagement, and you talk about something you call the disengagement canyon. I don't know if we've already covered that or if there's a little bit more that you'd want to say about that.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, I think one of the great challenges is that there, in the book, there's a picture of this canyon. We drew the canyon in 1992, and we thought we'd probably put it away by 1993. Unfortunately or fortunately, it has picked up speed every year since, and many companies just say, many organizations say, can you put our name on that? And what it really shows are these canyons between the leaders of an organization that can see what needs to be done but don't have their hands on the levers of change every day, the managers that are the poor souls that are stuck somewhere between the leaders so they have to receive what they say, and then the doers so they have to send to them something to do, and they're many times clueless, and then the doers that have their hands on change every day but can't see what needs to be done. And so what you find, and maybe even metaphorically, is that everybody is at a different altitude, and everybody sees the problems we face very differently. And so we're very fond of asking organizations to look at this picture, which is in the book, and say, why don't they all players, leaders, managers, and doers, see the same thing? And what happens if they don't? And I do think this ties back to two things. One, the canyon is a natural state. I think as long as the external environment changes, it creates changes and gaps between people at the different levels of an organization. But the second one, which is really how important it is to create a common line of sight or a common language that cuts across all these altitudes so that everybody can see the same thing and understand the same thing. You know, we have this wonderful saying that is, people will tolerate the conclusions of their leaders, but they will act on their own. And the reason it's so wonderful is because we've never found it not to be true. But if you're going to change the dynamic of that, which means that everybody's in a different corner, and that our conclusions are similar, then what we see in terms of our businesses must be explored equally. So everybody, leaders, managers, and individuals, must be able to see, you know, all the drama in our business, and given the decency to compare and contrast, to check and recheck, to unlearn and to relearn. And when they're given that opportunity, 99.9% people come to very similar conclusions. The problem is what each of us see is so different, our conclusions are so different, that, you know, again, these canyons get perpetuated.
Well, it's interesting how you approach this in your consulting work. I have interviewed other people who do organizational consulting of one sort or another. The thing that really leaps out at me as I look at your book that seems to distinguish your approach is your emphasis on both images and stories.
Yes.
So why are these important? And give us an example about how you use these in your in consulting to an organization.
You know, I heard this, but I've never found it, so don't quote my quoting of it. But I think Steven Spielberg, according to my recollection, said the only two things unique to human history are stories and games. Now, whether he said that or not, I find there to be a tremendous amount of truth in that, and I also believe there's a tremendous amount of opportunity. So basically, when we look at pictures or images, and especially when we look at visualizing stories, which again are metaphors, I think there's a couple interesting reflections. I think the first is, you know, Aristotle said the soul never thinks without a picture. So we do believe that when it comes to people having sort of their central processing unit in their head and their heart, that somehow they may more often than not create a picture of the world around them or around us, and then how we fit into it. But I think when it comes to multiple people, what we're looking at is, if a picture is worth 1,000 words, then a metaphor can be worth 1,000 pictures. And what that means is that when it comes to having people really understand business systems or organizational systems, which are true in any time people come together, the ability to visualize that creates a common mental practice field or a brain gym, so people don't spend all the time trying to interpret it. They can spend all their time together figuring how we're going to improve it. Now, let me give you one quick example here, because if we do this often, and why visualization can be so important. But if we had a room of 30 people right now, and I said, okay, I'm going to say a word, and I want you to just tell me what you think. And so the word is bear. And so, David, I'm just going to ask you, when I say bear, what do you think?
Big black grizzly bear.
Okay. big black grizzly. And then I'm going to go around the table right now and just pretend people are here. So the next person would say market. The next person would say trap. The next person would say Chicago. The next person would say naked. The next person would say feet. The next person would say polar. The next person would say koala. Next person would say aspirin. And the next person would say panda. And the last person would say teddy. And I would say, okay, gang, it's time to go. Let's go execute that son of a gun. And they would all just at that moment have this aha, where that's exactly what happens in many organizations, and that is this huge gap between what we say and what we mean. And if we can't mean the same thing, that our efforts are often in conflict with each other rather than in unison. And the true story is I was at a $30 billion company trying to visualize their strategy with them, and the chairman couldn't contain his excitement and said, that's perfect, that's exactly it. And then I saw the frown on the vice chairman's face, and he looked over and he said to the chairman, is that the way you see it? And he says, yes. They go, I can't believe we didn't do this sooner. He goes, well, then we better talk, because that's not what I thought you meant, and that's not what I've been doing. And when you consider the resources of a $30 billion company and the time and effort of the top two people that have gone towards trying to create the direction of that organization and then enlisting the support of all their people, that their meanings were not exactly the same. You just have to pause and say, wow. And then if you can come back and say, now, wait a minute, if visualization has the ability to ferret out interpretations and then lock on shared meaning, maybe this could become a powerful language that could be consistent with shared meaning across cultures and mores and experiences, so that people can really, back to my comment about belong, see how they belong in what we're trying to accomplish in this organization, and not be whipsawed by every week a different interpretation of that that creates frustration and ultimately disengagement.
Yes, as in your example with the bear, if we all have a different image in our minds and we're all going to go racing off in different directions. So what you do actually concretely in your consulting work is it looks like you have a whole staff of artists and that you actually bring them into the discussion, and in a collaborative fashion with the group that you're working with, you begin to have that artist create pictures and maps of the organizational system that everybody...
We do, you know, and again, it is an attempt to use visualization and data and dialogue to draw out the opinions and attitudes, conclusions, and beliefs of people so that they can be put on the table and merged into a common mental model that has shared meaning. The other thing that's interesting, David, is it is absolutely electric. What happens is, and maybe I could drop back for a second, I don't know how many of your listeners have ever been at a lounge or a bar or at a restaurant where they picked up a napkin or a cocktail napkin and tried to convey something to someone next to them, and then they asked a few questions, that person did, and they changed it, and they kept iterating on this cocktail napkin. Well, I don't know, but most people tell me that doesn't feel like work. That feels like creation, and it feels like something that's being built. So that's literally this concept of visual iteration. And the reason that's so fascinating from a psychological standpoint, in most organization teams, whether they're the senior team or a small team in a division or just a work team, there are people with ego. And inevitably, people have different ideas about how we should do things. And what we find more often than not, they vie for their ideas to win. And so sometimes that happens under the table, sometimes that happens on the table. But, you know, there are clearly people that feel like they're winners and losers. If you use visual iteration, not unlike a napkin sketch, as a group process where everybody's points and opinions count, and you continue to draw them out both figuratively and literally, and create a common picture, it's amazing because two or three things happen. The first thing is the egos just sort of disappear, and the childlike spirit of discovery reappears. The second thing that happens is that when we ask whose picture it is, everybody claims it's theirs, so the ownership becomes broad and rampant, And then the final thing, absolutely every time, as people step back and look at it, they realize that what they've created was never something that could have been created by one of them by themselves, but it was the magic of the vision, of the iteration and collaboration and conversation between people that created something unique and special, which somewhat sets them on fire because they feel like now they've got a clearer idea of what they need to go do together, more excitement about the fact that it's theirs, and then, quite frankly, the ability to get to bring others into it in a way that they can share that excitement and convey the meaning.
Wow. Yeah, this is so exciting to me. I have some background myself in organization consulting and development and meeting facilitation and so on. And it really, it moves things up a notch. I mean, I've seen a lot of techniques that try to move towards the kind of experience that you've just described, and some with more success than with others. But this just makes so much sense to me, the way that you bring in the visualization and the storytelling. I'm afraid that we're running out of time here. Jim, as we wrap up, is there any last thing that you'd like to leave our audience with?
Well, I just think that the big opportunity is that, in the U.S., 70% of our folks are disengaged. And I don't think it's by choice. I think a lot of our environments have created a sense of fear, and I think it does not have to be that way. And I think that if we can tap into that dormant capability of our people, we can get a lot better business results. But the way to do that is to remember that, human beings work here, and to look around the places they are absolutely ecstatic in their engagement and say, how can we steal some of those and bring it to the workplace so that their sense of accomplishment is equally high with where they spend 40 to 50% of their waking hours. I think that's a noble cause.
Well, I'll tell you, I think if I were a young guy, I would be knocking on your door looking for a job to figure out how I could work with your group. Jim Howden, thanks so much for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been a pleasure, David. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Jim Howden. I wish I could put a copy of this book in your hands. Both the black and white and the full color plate illustrations are wonderful, and they're a powerful argument for the sort of visual representation that seems to be the unique cornerstone of his company's approach to consulting. In the last chapter, Jim shares 12 lessons that he's learned about people and organizations. I won't read all 12, but let me share a few that really resonated with me. One of the things he learned is, quotes, "People won't change if they perceive the need to change to be an indictment of their past performance," end quote. Now, I really know that to be true. None of us likes to be blamed, and any whiff of blame is likely to tick us off and cause us to resist whatever change the blamer is trying to implement. He also says that he learned that, quotes, "to execute a strategy, people need an honest assessment of where they are and a clear picture of where they want to go," close quote. I think this observation is really the heart of what his book is about and underlies the entire strategy. Give people a map that clearly portrays the current situation, the goal, and how to get there. And one last one. He says he learned that, quote, "dialogue is the oxygen of change." This, of course, applies not only to organizational life, but also to relationships in general, including psychotherapy.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast got the pod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
Okay, let's do a little mental experiment. Let's imagine that I came to your city to conduct these interviews in person at a local coffee place, for example, a Starbucks. Would you be willing to treat me to a cup of coffee? I'll bet you would. Well, basically, that's what I'm asking you to do to provide some financial support for Shrink Wrap Radio. The highest donation level I've put on the donations page is $10 a month for 12 months. Given that I put out 4 podcasts a month, and sometimes more, that comes to $2.50 per podcast, less than a large cup of coffee at Starbucks. So if you want to be a super donor, buy me a cup of coffee each week for a year. Or if that's too much, there are lower levels of donations possible too. So be sure to take a look at the new donate page at shrinkwrapradio.com. By the way, be sure to check out the latest interview on my other podcast series at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. It's with Dr. Alan Rappaport talking about a fascinating approach to psychotherapy known as control mastery theory. It's a good one. Those of you who are technology mavens will probably know how to use Dig. I've started to put a Dig button on each interview on the site. I'd really appreciate it if you'd go ahead and give interviews you like a dig. It will help this show's rankings on Google searches. Finally, if you're not subscribed to Shrink Wrap Radio, please do so. This is separate from the whole donation issue. It's free to subscribe, and you'll notice a button on the site that says Subscribe in iTunes, and clicking on that page will take you directly to the right place to subscribe in iTunes.
Hey, this is Matt Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Matthew. Now let's check out some email from our listener community. First, we hear from longtime listener Cody in Israel, who writes, "Hi, Dave. It seems to me that it's been a long time from the time I thanked you for your great shows. You are a wonderful reporter, and each of your shows is so enjoyable, and also I learn a lot. Listening to your show with Dr. James Wanless, I don't know why, but I just became so moved. You both were talking to each other as if some great old friends. And as far as I understood, that was the first time you both met." That's true. That was the first time, and there was a really nice sense of rapport between the two of us. I really enjoyed that, and I think I want to talk to him some more. She goes on to write, "Did you meet him personally, or did you just meet him on the show over Skype? I couldn't understand that part." Yes, I did. That Skype call was, our first meeting. Anyway, listening to that show, I remembered something. As far as I understand, you got the invitation to teach once again at your university. If I understand, you're not so happy about the offer, but you need the money. So what I was thinking was maybe you have a friend who would like to share with you the course, and you would both teach. Some weeks he will teach, some weeks you will teach. That would give you the money and also the free time without the anxiety that you have when you have to teach. No, it's not my original idea. One of my friends did that during a lot of years, and he and his friend liked that arrangement. I wish I would do that also when our son was ill. Take care, Cody. Well, that's a good suggestion, Cody. In fact, I have done what we call team teaching in years past. However, I don't want to share the money, but I do have techniques that ease the load. I'll bring in lots of guest speakers, probably. I like to get graduate students who are willing to be teaching assistants, and that helps carry the load quite a bit. So I have my own little tricks, and yet I do continue to be ambivalent about whether or not I really want to go ahead and teach that course. It's just something that I did for so long, and I'm just questioning, do I really want to go back, or do I want to actually try to embrace being retired? And so I'll keep you posted on that. The next one comes from Terry. I think that's how the name is pronounced. I'm not sure. It's T-E-R-R-E. She also comments on my interview with Dr. James Wanless. She writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I finally got the chance to listen to your podcast with James Wanless. What a dynamic conversation you two had, and I'm so thrilled that you were so synced with each other. It made for an especially enjoyable edition of one of my very favorite podcasts, Shrink Wrap Radio." Now, of course, Terry was especially thrilled because I think she was the one who suggested that he would make a great guest. So once again, I thank you for that, Terry. Terry goes on to say, I really like that you encourage your guests to bloom fully as you interview them. By that, I mean that you follow the subtle cues the guests provide, and without an agenda, you follow and explore. Thank you for the especially dynamic interview. The two of you have such great energy together. I have to admit that I liked that you read my letter recommending Dr. Wanless as a guest on the air. Blessings, Tara. So thanks again for that recommendation, Terry, and if you have others, I'll be especially open to them. You might remember Sarah Hanna Radcliffe, who I've interviewed a couple of times and plan to interview again. She writes the following, Hi, Dr. Dave. I just finished listening to your recent interview on Murder Most Psychological with Dr. Islieb. I really enjoyed it. I love Dr. Islieb's candid discussion about her career path, her thoughts, and her writing business. That's one of the wonderful things about your show. It gives us a chance to look at the really human side of our profession to see how people actually live it and express it. And there are obviously so many ways to do both. It is endlessly fascinating. I just finished reading a terrific book by Dawson Church called The Genie in Your Genes. You interviewed this author quite a while ago, and I followed up by getting his book, as I often do with your guests. I highly recommend this text to your listeners. It offers a wonderful paradigm shift for physical and psychological healing, but does it in a very readable and very scientific way. Anyone who wants to be really current in our field must take a look. Well, that's it for now. Keep doing your wonderful thing. Take care, Sarah Hanna. Well, you know, maybe I should reach out to Dawson Church and see if he'll send me a copy of that book and perhaps interview him again about that book. Finally, let's read one more, this one from Matthew, who describes himself as a rather newish listener. Matthew writes, Dr. Dave, let me get the fan praise out first. I came across Shrink Wrap Radio about 3 months ago, and it's been one of my top favorites ever since. Yay! The variety and depth of topics and the interviews are consistently entertaining and educational. I've been greatly interested in some of the, I guess you would call them, Eastern influence topics that have been coming up and how they're being applied in the field. I have a background in martial arts, so the Scottish Ninja and the discussions on mindfulness have been of particular interest. I'm currently going through a career change via an MSW program. That would be Masters of Social Work. For all those who might not know, I've been working in fields ranging from theater, IT management, software development to public safety. So the switch has been fairly extreme but very interesting and worthwhile. My focus is on interpersonal and mental health work with the general goal of working in a clinical setting somewhere down the road. As it happens, I'm attending one of your former schools in one of your favorite towns, the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. All right. I look forward to many more fascinating shows. Many thanks for your hard work and dedication here in the Podosphere. Matt in A Squared. P.S. I would like to suggest another possible guest for you to interview to fill in the ever-growing list. Ken Day, and he gives a web link to www.shamanstouch.com, is a Cincinnati-based shamanic practitioner, author, martial artist, and systemic constellation worker, among many other skills. He's also a genuinely nice guy who I think would make for an excellent interview subject. Okay, that's two folks now, at least, that have been added to my list. He writes, PPS, please do keep on Twittering. I'm one of your followers there and appreciate the notes you send out. Matt, it's great to hear from you. One of my best friends went through the doctoral program in social work there at the University of Michigan, so I know they have a good program. And speaking of Twittering, those of you who aren't following my tweets can follow them at twitter.com/shrinkwrapradio, where I announce recent interviews, mention movies I've just seen, and provide links to websites that have caught my interest. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio, and you can leave comments about individual shows. Take a look at the comments area. People are leaving some good comments. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod, and you're encouraged to leave voice messages using MyChingo or on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Jim Howden for his insights on the art of engagement. I know I said this last time, but my next guest really will be Dr. Philippe Golden of Stanford University, who, among other things, has been using fMRI brain imaging to study the effects of both meditation and cognitive behavioral therapy. I think you'll want to hear that one. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.